today is the summer solstice. So it's the lightest day of the year, at least in our half of the world. And I wanted to talk about how we deal with some of our darkest times. And I think it's only fitting to talk about that on the lightest day of the year, because our practice is constantly teaching us that within the light there is darkness, and within the darkness there is light. I was touched by one of our Sangha mates' question 2 weeks ago when Alan gave the Dharma talk on the poem about spring everywhere and talking about the blossoms and the buds. And Zach made the comment that it is really difficult sometimes when you're feeling so bad to see the spring that's all around us. And I so resonated with that. I expect all of you can, that there are times when it's a beautiful day out, as we've had so many beautiful days, and you're in some kind of hell realm, minor maybe, or sometimes major. This place we go, this place of discouragement. We all have our places. We all have the times and the settings and the circumstances where we fall into deep discouragement. It might be because we feel we've failed at something, or a friend has an illness that isn't getting better. Or we feel like we're growing older and losing our energy. Or we're too young and we're not experienced enough yet. Or we're too short, or we're too tall. So many reasons, so many wonderful excuses to be discouraged. And of course, there are so many things in the world. The tragedy in Orlando, one of the many things that happens in the world that can make us so discouraged about life. So I want to read again the reading that I asked Chip to lead us in by Joan Tollefson. Joan Tollefson is she calls herself a non-dual practitioner. She's been certainly a Zen practitioner and practiced in other meditation traditions, but the core of her teaching is a core of Zen, which is non-duality, that no separation, no categories, all one big, intertwined, ever-changing universe. And in this book, Nothing to Grasp, she writes this paragraph. Part of waking up is becoming sensitive to how we become discouraged, how we close down, and where we go for false comfort. To wake up is to become aware of the tendency to judge ourselves, to take our failures personally, to fall into despair, self-pity, depression, frustration, anger, or wherever we tend to go when we believe the story that we are a person who can't do it right. Seeing all of this is enough. Awareness is its own action. We don't need to analyze it or impose changes based on our ideas of what should be happening. Just being awake to the present moment as it is and seeing clearly what is happening, this is transformative. We are simply awake here and now. awareness is its own action. I want to come back to that. But I think all of us come to Zen with the secret hope that these periods of discouragement, of sadness, of despair, they'll go away, that practice will take them away. And of course we have that longing, and why wouldn't we? I mean, in some ways, yes, we know that can never really happen, and yet the wish is so strong, and it keeps coming up. And here we are, moving in and out of discouraged states, hell realms. What is there actually to wake up to? What could waking up even be when we're talking about feeling so depressed, or so filled with grief, or so filled with anger? What is waking up about? And this is where I think Joan Tollefson phrases things very nicely. She talks about an analogy that I think we've all heard, which is how we tend to create maps of the world. Our thoughts, our feelings weave stories about who we are in the world and what the world is like, and that we mistake the maps that we make for the actual terrain, for the spring that's everywhere, for the garbage that's everywhere, for just the actual thing. We mistake the sentence, "the water is cold," for the actual experience of tasting cold water. And Joan Tollefson goes on right after the paragraph we read to write, "Waking up is discerning the difference between the description and the actuality of this present moment. Liberation is simply being the territory itself." I want to say that again. Liberation is simply being the territory itself. That which we already are and can't not be. So it's not thinking about the territory itself, it's simply knowing that we are it. Confusion is always in the map. Any story of improvement or failure, however relatively true it may appear to be, is one more mirage to see through as it arises. It takes thought, memory, and imagination to conjure it up. Wherever you go, here you are, and there is never any more here-ness than there is right now, whatever form here and now takes. So what she reminds us of is that discouragement is a story. The hell realm is a story, different from actual pain or discomfort, different from the heavy feeling I get in my chest when I think about my friend who's so sick, different from the thing that happened at work that's going to make me change my course, that I'm telling myself an unhappy story about. That the terrain is simply what is. Now, she also reminds us that maps are also real. So thoughts, human beings, human minds create maps. They create hell realms, they create discouragement. Absolutely real. The delusive part is not in the thoughts themselves, but in believing that the thoughts are it, that the map is the terrain.
But how do we work with that?
So this morning, I'm lying in bed. It's 6 a.m. and I'm supposed to get up and get ready to do my morning meditation. And I am living in the midst of discouragement. Really unhappy about something that's going on at work. Really annoyed with myself for not being as giving as I wanted to be with a friend who needed my time yesterday. Oh, and then I had to give a Dharma talk tonight. What was I going to say? I wasn't going to have anything to say. Nobody was going to want to listen to me. All this at 6 a.m. I did not want to get out of bed. I did not want to face the day. And that was a pretty minor hell realm. But nonetheless, so real. And in that moment, I couldn't see that it was a map. It was my whole universe. How do we wake up from that? And she tells us that waking up is just to be aware of the tendency to judge ourselves, just to be aware, telling myself a story that I'm not going to have anything to say during this Dharma talk tonight. To take our failures personally. To take it personally that I let myself down yesterday when I wasn't really as helpful to a friend as I might have been. That this was me, this was Bob's failure. That's what Tollefson is reminding us of. It's taking it personally. This is my failure, my despair, my discouragement. Well, it hurts. But more than that, believing that the map is the terrain can send us into all kinds of hurtful behavior. Places, as she says, places that we go for false comfort. So when we're in those discouraged places, that's when we say hurtful things. That's when we reach for things we really don't need or want, fueling so much of the numbing that we do, whether it's numbing with drugs or alcohol or numbing with distraction. And Tollefson knows whereof she speaks. She was a heroin addict. She was an alcoholic. She was a chain smoker. And she talks about all of this. This is a woman who really knows her hell realm. And what she talks about is waking up to the reality that these hell realms are not personal. That these stories we tell ourselves of discouragement and sadness and failure are just part of what it means to have a body and a mind and to be in the world. Yesterday I was sitting outside reading, and actually I was reading this book, and I felt things crawling all over my feet. So I looked down, and there was a parade of ants going across my toes because I'd put my foot down in the place where they wanted to go. And I got really interested in this. So I started watching, and then I took a leaf and I put it down in their path and watched what happened. And they stopped, and then some of them went around it, and like three of them went and picked up the leaf and carried it off. And then I started putting like little pebbles down, and it was like being a kid again. But then it occurred to me, because I had been thinking about discouragement, and I was thinking, you know, I bet, I can't tell you for sure, but I bet those ants didn't stand there, look at the leaf and say, oh, I've failed, it's hopeless. They don't take it personally. They just move on, move around, move through, pick it up, move on. Now, of course, we are these miraculously sentient beings. We're not ants.
But
from that big all one category perspective, we are. We're all moving through the world, all with our pains and our joys, sometimes being able to see the spring blossoms and sometimes being completely oblivious. Nothing wrong with that. But how do we wake up? Well, what she says is that awareness is its own action. What kind of awareness? Okay, so I'm lying there this morning telling myself a story of dread. It's going to be a bad day. It's going to be a bad Dharma talk. And then something shifts. And I remember, oh. First, I notice that I am actually getting out of bed. And then I think, oh, it's time to get out of bed. And then I notice that, in fact, I'm going and I'm brushing my teeth and things are changing and shifting and my body is changing. And suddenly I'm just not in that discouraged place anymore. And what I remember is, oh yeah, that's what this is. That what happens, and we can't choose it, is that suddenly we become aware that this was a mind state, that it wasn't reality, it was simply Bob's story. I couldn't choose that. It happened to me. Just like when we're sitting in Zazen and we get carried off by a thought. We don't choose when we're going to come back to presence. We really don't. We can try really hard, but if you think about it, you never choose. You suddenly wake up, oh, I'm back. That's the way it happens with these hell realms. That's the way it happens with discouragement. Suddenly we're out of it. Suddenly there's a teeny bit of light coming through a crevice. There's a teeny bit of space between me and the story of failure that I'm taking so personally. I haven't been able to choose it, but what Joan Tollefson writes about is the capacity to notice it, to really notice how it happens, what it's been like, where we are now. That's the difference between practice and not practice. It's not making ourselves leave those hell realms. We can't do that. It's appreciating those instances of waking up when the hell realms leave us. One of the ways that sustained practice works is by having us see this over and over again. So coming back here every week, sitting on the cushion at home, you watch it happen over and over again. Going to Sesshin, many times I have sat in a terrible, terrible state for a whole morning or a whole afternoon, and then suddenly it's gone. I haven't been able to make it go away, can't make it stay away, it's just gone. That experience over and over again whittles away the story, whittles away the completeness with which we take ourselves so personally, and that is the heart of the practice of waking up to discouragement. So she says, seeing all of this is enough. She's saying we don't have to do anything except pay attention. Awareness is its own action. We don't need to analyze it or impose changes based on our ideas about what should be happening. Just being awake to the present moment as it is and seeing clearly what is happening, this is transformative. We are simply awake here and now. So, thoughts, stories, as the light wanes on this longest day of the year? Yeah, Chip.
But I am wondering how she gave up the heroin and the drinking. And I'm thinking about resignation and resolve. often when people quit these bad and addictive habits, they form a resolve to do it and then eventually do that. But my stepdad's an example. He, you know, drank heavily and smoked for decades. And somehow he gave it up, both of them up, on one day. Just stopped both of them. I don't know what he went through. And when I asked him about it, he just said, well, I just gave it up. But with the resolve, isn't that a story too, but one that helps you get out? And I'm wondering.
Yeah. You're absolutely like in that place that we talk about all the time, which is this sort of balance between, well, we're not doing nothing. And if we just do nothing, then we don't practice, then nothing happens, right?
Yeah.
On the other hand, what the teaching is, we don't really control this. So the question is, why was your stepfather able to give those things up then? Not before, not later. Why did I wander into James Ford's church when I did and get involved in Zen? Not before, not later. That there's some way in which both we have these intentions, these resolves that are really important, and we're not in control. And it is one of these great mysteries, I think, of our lives, that it's both.
Like, you know, what moment do I dive into the cold water? Because I'm there saying, well, it's cold, and then at some moment, but then, you just have to do it, so.
And how do you decide, right, and how do you,
yeah.
And is it, the have you really decided,
later.
Or have you just, Carolyn.
Thank you for picking that quote. We've read it before, and I always love it. It's sort of a different view than a lot of other Zen things. And it got me into the book, which I also think is wonderful. And one of the things that really sticks with me, very related to what she was saying, is that she's very open in looking at her own experiences and saying, I actually don't know why it worked this time. This is the 15th time that I've tried to stop smoking, and this time it stuck. I don't know why. And she says, and of course, as therapists, we are always making up these stories. Well, it happened because she had this support, and you know that happened. Everything got worked through. We make up these very elaborate stories. She says, I honestly don't know. There are forces in the universe. Some of them are in me. Some of them are friends. Some of them are, you know, in the stars. Who knows why it stuck this time? And it was particularly poignant to me when she talks about, read the whole thing about what she says was sort of her most shameful habit. She chews on her fingers or fingernails or cuticles, whatever, and she's always been deeply ashamed of it, and she can't stop it. And she says, for years she stopped. She tried everything. She tried psychotherapy, she tried, you know, behavior therapy, she tried, nothing worked, and it stops. It stops.
Right.
And she doesn't know why. And then sometimes it comes back. And she gave up on beating herself up when it comes back, or praising herself when she stopped, because I think she really had the experience, which I think we probably all had, but don't want to admit, that we really don't have very much control over these things. Mm-hmm. We make up incredible stories about why this time it worked, and then why it fails again. And so there's something really very, very forgiving in her. All that matters is noticing. Noticing is an action, and it's an extremely important action. It's not control over our behavior.
Right.
It's just noticing.
Right. Right. And that it's transformative. That it's, you know, as Josh is fond of saying, it's not nothing. That there's something that really happens, and we're not in control. And we need to have these intentions to wake up for things to happen. It is, well, it's absolutely a mystery.
Well, James is saying that we're become more accident prone.
Yeah.
Right, that it is an accident, but this kind of meditation can really make us more prone to having those sort of accidents.
Yeah.
Self-control.
Yeah.
Very humbling.
Yeah.
I was going to say humiliating. I guess it's that too.
Well.
To not have any control over what you spend your life trying to control.
Yeah.
But also very liberating.
Yeah. Spirit.
Yes, Paul. Thank you also for choosing this particular reading, which is quite wonderful, and for putting your finger on the essential part of it, that sense about awareness as its own action. But when I hear this business about not having any control, I mean, I certainly wouldn't argue that I'm in control, and yet I begin to get a little bit agitated inside, because I want to think that I can bring some degree of choice to it, that I have the ability to multiply moments of awareness.
Mm.
And I'm not really sure that that is true. But I feel that if I leave go of that, I kind of surrender to the vicissitudes of karma, you know? I'm completely at the mercy of whatever karma I have accumulated, and I'm going to do what I'm going to do and no more in the way of practice. But one of the things that's helpful here that you said is this idea of sustained practice and the effect of sustained practice, that you actually see it over and over again. You know, you can't make it go away. Everybody on retreat or not on retreat has that experience. You can't make it go away. And yet it does, that things change. So if that is repeated sufficiently often, I think to myself, then maybe finally I'll get it. You know, that this is the way it is, and that it's okay.
Yeah.
But in my present state, that is a kind of a disturbing thing to acknowledge. And I think that's part of practice, you know. It's letting go of the idea that you can produce some sort of special state that's going to be uplifting, that is something other than exactly what she calls the terrain rather than the map.
Yeah.
That's practice.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, thank you for pointing that out.
Yeah.
One just very small story. Tonight I remembered, I should bring flowers. And I tend to really tell many stories about all the obstacles I'm going to have. Obstacles all the time, how things are going to turn out terribly. The dinner's not going to be good. I'm not going to be ready for the guests constantly. So then I was like, oh, I'm meant to buy some flowers. There are no perennials outside. I have nothing. What am I going to do? And it's like almost 7 o'clock. I just walked up in the backyard, and I don't have perennials, or very, very few. But all of a sudden, all these things appeared. Oh, the dogwood is in bloom. Mm. Snip.
Mm.
Oh yeah, I don't really like the astilbe, but they will look nice if I have three. Mm. And before I knew it, I put together, I said, my husband walked in, I said, I did it again. I did it again. Magic happened again. I have this really nice bouquet of flowers that did not exist 10 minutes prior.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. And the story, you were completely convinced.
Oh, absolutely. Right. I'm always very convinced.
Yeah, absolutely. That's wonderful. Doina.
I think I could really relate with kind of, I think there's something about accepting that you waken up, because when I was younger, and I would have moments of waking up from maybe my sadness or depression, but then I wouldn't want to accept it. I'd want to keep on being sad because maybe I thought that's why I didn't know that's how I should be. But I think then compared to now there's when I see that I've waken up, I can accept it. Oh, things have changed. They don't have to. I don't have to make myself be the same way. I don't have to make myself continue being the way I think I have to be.
Right, so you can notice that you had this impulse to hold on to where you were, and now you're more able to just let it go, to meet what's coming up that's different.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's really powerful when you begin to notice that kind of clinging, and then I can just let it go. Yeah. Bill.
It reminds me of a story in another practice that I do, and we talk about a gardener, and so the gardener wants to grow plants, so he has to get the right soil, he has to have the sun come out every day, he might have to put a fence around the area where he's planting the seeds, he has to really water, cultivate, maybe he has to pull some dandelions or weeds, all these little activities that the gardener does throughout time. The gardener himself can't make the plant grow.
Yeah.
The gardener can't force the plant to grow. The gardener can only do what the gardener can do in terms of things that are going to foster an environment where the plants may ultimately be able to grow. The gardener can't directly make the plants grow. But all these things that are done over time, the planting, the fencing, watching out for the insects, watering, fertilizing. Although they don't directly cause the result, they create an environment where they're told it's all going to happen. And so one day, if the gardener keeps doing his practice, keeps doing what he has to do, one day the garden bears fruit. And it suddenly comes. It's just there. And so I kind of think about practice in that way, too, about Zen practice. I can't come in and sit with a cushion. Forced by my own will, and I won't become awake, that I'll notice where my thinking is all the time, and I won't become more balanced or understand that everything is the same and so forth. And, but yet over time, it'll, in some ways it becomes apparent. I think I spoke to you once. You said Zen practice is a lot like, so you're driving a car, and it's, you know, it's kind of raining a little bit, but it's almost mist. You say, well, it's not really raining. And over time, when you're driving, you don't really notice that the mist is starting to collect, and it becomes apparent over time. And you say, well, there's the mist. You didn't see it coming, but it kind of surreptitiously developed over time, like the garden.
Yeah.
And I come, I create the environment, and hope to be enlightened, but I can't force it. But if I do all these things, perhaps everything will come.
Yeah, and that's it's a wonderful analogy, and that's, you know, if you think about it, we construct all these forms and we do all these rituals in part to just, we are like pulling the weeds and we're making the fence and we're doing all those things.
And I still have to say, I don't think I understand all the forms.
Yeah. But
that's okay.
You know, the other thing we do is we create these places where we remind each other of this. So we're all reminding each other of the reality of what it means to get lost and then awake and tell ourselves stories that are so painful and then see a little crack of light. So we do that with each other, and that's part of the weeding and the tilling of the soil that we do with all these forms we have. Yeah. Seems like a good place to make impossible vows. Thank you all.
The closing chant is on the last page of the book, page 60, for Bodhisattva.